Hey there, it's Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli, and I want to chat with you about a key ingredient for a fabulous date night, feeling sexy. And come on, let's be real. What you wear plays a big part in how you rock that confidence. That's why I'm thrilled to introduce you to Quince. Quince brings you premium European linen dresses, blouses, and shorts starting at just $30, along with washable silk tops, 40-karat gold jewelry, and more. And guess what? All of their goodies are priced 50 to 80% lower than similar brands. By teaming up directly with top factories, Quince skipped the middleman and hands us the saving. Plus, they stick to factories with safe, ethical practices and top-notch fabrics and finishes. How awesome is that? Picking from Quince's website was tough, because they have a ton of fabulous choices. I ended up going for their 100% washable silk sleep dress in champagne. And let me tell you, my husband was floored. He's convinced whoever rocks this is in for a blast. I'm going to record some content on that dress so you can see how fabulous is that dress. Elevate your date night style with Quince. Pop over to quince.com/sexology for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/sexology to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/sexology.
Welcome to Sexology, a podcast that untangles the science of sex and pleasure. And now, with this week's episode, your host, clinical psychologist, Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli.
Hello there. Welcome to another episode of Sexology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli, and today we're diving deep into a topic that affects millions of women worldwide: menopause and its impact on sexual medicine. This is part of our middle life series for women. We already aired 4 episodes, and this is one of the last episodes. So joining us today is Dr. Laura Stryker, a renowned expert in gynecology and sexual medicine. Dr. Stryker is a clinical professor at Northwestern University School of Medicine and the medical director of the Northwestern Medicine Center for Sexual Medicine and Menopause. She also has her own podcast, and she published multiple books on this topic. Check out her full bio in the show notes. In today's episode, we'll be exploring some common questions surrounding menopause and sexual health, such as the concept of hot flash hell, the causes of painful sex, and strategies to improve sexual function during and after menopause. Before we dive in, I want to remind you guys to download our free book. I wrote this book a few years ago for my own clients who were struggling with low libido. In the book, I'll talk about what are some of the common reasons for women struggling with low libido and what are some of the possible solutions. You can find it in the show notes. And as I said, it's completely free, my gift to you. So whether you're experiencing menopause yourself or simply want to learn more about this topic, stay tuned for our conversation with Dr. Laura Stryker. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Sexology Podcast. I am so excited to welcome Dr. Lauren Stryker to our show. Dr. Stryker, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am very excited. I know you have your own podcast, you're a published writer. You talk about these things every day, and you're just the perfect person for having this conversation with. You know, whenever I go to conferences, different places, colleagues who are older, and they stop me and they tell me that they used to have fantastic sex life, but now sex is painful. They just don't want to be intimate. One of the colleagues that I talked to, she said, like, I feel after menopause, I just realized I don't like my husband. So I hear all of these scary tales. So tell us, what are some of the common changes that women might experience as they enter their perimenopausal years and menopausal years?
Well, let's start with the fact that it's not like every single woman has amazing, fabulous, pain-free sex before she goes through menopause. We know up to 40% of women have difficulty, whether it's pain with penetrative sex or maybe difficulty with their libido or a hard time having an orgasm. And then perimenopause and menopause come, and suddenly on top of whatever issues someone might be having, now they are dealing with this plunge in estrogen and sometimes testosterone, which is going to have a significant impact on most women. And in fact, we're talking about 70% of women will have changes in the vulva and the vagina that will impact on their ability to have pain-free, pleasurable sex. So specifically, what are we talking about? Well, the name of the medical condition is genitourinary syndrome of menopause, which is abbreviated GSM. And basically what genitourinary syndrome of menopause is a constellation of anatomic changes, such as the tissue gets thin, it gets dry, and there's no lubrication, and also a constellation of specific symptoms, things like pain with intercourse or an inability to have intercourse, or maybe non-sexual things like burning and itching. And then we have the urinary symptoms, that gotta go feeling or recurrent urinary tract infections. It's all part of what happens specifically because of the fact that your ovaries are no longer making estrogen.
Well, that makes sense. And I know you also talk about hot flash hell. I think that's something that you use. And yeah. I haven't entered that stage of my life, and all of these things sound so scary. So do tell us about that and if we have any solution for that.
Well, first of all, let me start by saying there are solutions for everything. I am completely solution driven because it doesn't do any good to tell anybody what bad things are going to happen to them if you cannot give safe, effective solutions. And quite frankly, that's why I'm out there talking to women. That's why I've written my books. That's why I do my podcasts, because too often women go to their doctors and they are not given solutions. So they assume that they're are no solutions. And in fact, there are solutions for every single symptom of menopause that we're going to talk about. Now, the fact that you brought up hot flashes is interesting and important, because when we think in terms of sexuality, people don't really focus on hot flashes. But in fact, that's a big part of the equation. And the reason is that when you look at what drives libido, well, libido is very multifactorial. Many, many things, whether it's hormones, physical changes, psychosocial problems. You mentioned, I hate my husband. I always say sometimes you need HRT. That's husband replacement therapy. We have to figure out, is that relationship really working for you, or does it need something? But when it comes to those hot flashes, the specific impact that that has, in addition to making people feel miserable, is it's almost impossible to get a decent night's sleep. And I can tell you that if someone is not sleeping, when they see that pillow, they are not thinking about sex. They are thinking about getting a good night's sleep. But aside from the sexual issues of hot flashes, what a lot of people are not aware, that these hot flashes are not just about quality of life. It's also about length of life. We know that hot flashes impact on brain health, on cardiovascular health, on bone health, because every time someone has a hot flash, there's an inflammatory reaction, which is going to impact organs throughout the body. So when we talk about perimenopause and menopause symptoms, it's important to not ignore any of these symptoms, even if you think it's not something that really matters.
Such an important thing to consider, that some people feel like, you know, I can endure during it, I can kind of like muscle through it, but it seems like it does have profound impact on people's well-being.
Well, let's talk about that idea of toughing it out. You know, should a woman just say, okay, come on, I'm a woman, I'm strong, I can do it this, I can dress in layers, I can get my fan. Well, no, this is not something you want to tough out, and I'll tell you why. First of all, we started off talking about genitourinary syndrome of menopause, the issues that impact on the vagina and the vulva and the bladder. Those do not go away. Too often I hear women say, I'm done with menopause. You're done with menopause when you die, because menopause is that your ovaries are no longer producing estrogen, and it's not like they're going to start producing estrogen later in life. Most women, when they say they're done with menopause, what they're referring to is they're no longer having hot flashes. But the changes that occur in the bladder, the vulva, and the vagina are going to continue and, in fact, get worse throughout life unless they're treated. So no, you don't tough that out. And in fact, someone who says, I'm just going to endure the pain, we know that when someone is having intercourse or attempting intercourse and there's pain, not only is it not going to get better, but it's going to get worse, because your pelvic floor muscles are also just going to tighten up. It's going to go into protective keep out mode. And then we get to those hot flashes that I mentioned, the toughing out the hot flashes. Well, I don't know if you want to guess the average amount of time that women have hot flashes. Want to go there?
I don't know. Whatever friend I have, whoever I have that they're in menopausal stage, they feel all the time, like 70%. I don't know.
Right. But how long do they last? I mean, that's one of the biggest misconceptions out there.
I don't know. A couple of hours?
No. How many years?
How many years? Okay.
How many years are you? If you say I'm going to tough this out.
Now you're scaring me. Like 3 years?
Average length of having hot flashes in the United States is 7 to 10 years.
Oh my God.
Now keep in mind that's average. And there's a genetic component and there is an ethnic component. So we know that for white women, it's roughly 7 years. We know that for Black women, not only do they start hot flashes sooner and they tend to be much more difficult, but they last longer. We're looking 10 to 11 years on average. And for some people, it's lifelong. So this idea that, oh, I'm just going to tough out my hot flashes isn't appropriate or realistic when you think about how long they're going to last for most women. And also, just to be clear, you know, when we say, for example, that Asian women have the shortest period of time of hot flashes, more like, you know, 5 years. And a lot of people say, well, maybe that's diet related. Maybe that's because they eat more vegetables and fish and rice. And that's not true. We know that Asian women that eat cheeseburgers have less hot flashes, just like their counterparts that are eating, you know, more typically Asian food, if you will. This is a genetic thing. It's not a diet thing.
I love that you brought up so many good points that I have question about, because I remember at some point I saw a Harvard study that talked about consumption of certain food helping with hot flashes. Is that the case, or there's thing people can do with their diet to change it?
Yeah, it's not. I wish that it was. You know, certainly we know that there are certain triggers. Some people will get a hot flash if they drink red wine or if they eat spicy food. But if someone is having a lot of hot flashes, this idea that you're going to alter your diet and it's going to make a difference, it simply doesn't. And, you know, there's so many books out there that talk about hot flash diets and recipes, and not one single scientific study has shown that it makes a difference. And by the same token, when we look at a lot of the products that are being recommended and that are being sold, a lot of these over-the-counter botanicals, and whether it's red clover or Chinese herbs, and I did an entire episode on that really looked at the science behind it. And the truth of the matter is that the overwhelming majority of those products do absolutely nothing. And that includes black cohosh. Because what's going on here is a huge placebo effect. And we know that if you give a woman anything and she believes that it's going to help her hot flashes, it will. These products will all work, but they won't be sustained. Meaning by the time you're into 3 or 4 months, that product is no longer going to work. And we've already established that hot flashes are going to last, you know, 10 years or more. So this idea that you're going to take one of these over-the-counter products or one of these silly things that a lot of the celebrities are selling is just, it's taking advantage of women who are just desperately looking for solutions. And they are operating under the assumption that estrogen is dangerous. And that is not, it's just simply not the case. We know that estrogen is by far the safest, most effective way to eliminate hot flashes. And we also know, and this is the one that really gets people like dropping their jaw, is estrogen decreases, not increases, estrogen decreases your risk of developing breast cancer by 18%. And that's one of the biggest myths out there, is that if you take estrogen, it's going to increase the risk. And that was all based on the 2002 WHI study that they showed there was a slight increase in breast cancer in women that were taking hormone therapy, but it was only in the group that was taking estrogen and a synthetic progesterone. And if you looked at the women who were only taking estrogen, they found that the rates of breast cancer actually went down. And as if you needed any further proof, if we look at breast cancer rates today, the number of women that get breast cancer, it has increased every single year for the last 20 years. Now think about this. If hormone therapy was the culprit and all these women flushed their hormones down the toilet 20 years ago, we would see a significant decline. But instead, we're seeing an increase. So we have a lot of good evidence that estrogen is not going to cause breast cancer. Women get breast cancer. You know, we know that obesity is a risk factor. We know that alcohol is a risk factor. We know that, of course, family history is huge. I'm not minimizing breast cancer, and I'm as concerned as everyone else about what we can do to decrease it. But it's not avoiding estrogen.
Well, when we're talking about hormone replacement therapy, HRT, we already talked about the other HRT. Like
we now call it HT, hormone therapy. Okay. And there's a specific reason for that, why the name has been changed. Because hormone replacement therapy implies that you're going to be replacing hormones at the same level that you made when you were 20 or 30. And that's not what we're doing. We're giving very, very small amounts of estrogen, and sometimes a progestogen if someone has a uterus, to alleviate symptoms and to support bone health and bladder health and all the other things that we're going to talk about. And so it's really more appropriate to call it hormone therapy instead of hormone replacement therapy. It's not like if your thyroid is removed, you're going to get enough thyroid to reproduce the levels that you had before your thyroid is removed. We're not doing that with menopause.
Well, when we think about the options out there, it's really good to know that some, based on what I'm hearing, some lifestyle changes can help, but it's not like when we diet, it's not what people kind of believe, right? As far as how impactful it is. And when we're talking about a hormone therapy, it seems like it helps with hot flashes. What about the rest of the symptoms of menopause? Yeah. Is it impactful?
So when we talk about hormone therapy, just to be clear, there's really two kinds of hormone therapy, if you will. One is systemic, which means it affects your entire body, all the cells in your body. And this is going to be hormones that are either taken orally by mouth or that are going to be taken through the skin, the transdermal hormones. These are patches, sprays, gels, and things like that, as opposed to local estrogen therapy, which is estrogen that is applied to the vagina or the vulva to specifically help with the bladder and the vulvar and vaginal symptoms. So when we talk about systemic therapy, giving systemic levels of estrogen, what's it going to do for you? Well, it's going to help your hot flashes. It's going to help you sleep. It's going to help your cognitive function. It's going to help your bones. That's huge. It's going to help your bone health. But it also will help your bladder and your vagina. What we do know is that the systemic levels that we use in about 80% of women that are taking them will give enough support to the vagina and the vulva and the bladder so that you don't have a lot of the symptoms I talked about earlier. But some people are also going to need a local vaginal estrogen. But you get a lot of bang for your buck with using a systemic estrogen. And I think the thing that we need to focus more on, aside from the hot flashes, which is in and of itself enough, is looking at things like cognitive function, sleep quality, and long-term bone health. These are all very important.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, that those things can impact the quality of our relationship, therefore right. kind of our desire. So if we're snappy, if we're irritated, it's hard to have the good enough relationship for most people to be sexual with the partner. So that also can
right.
contribute.
It all follows. You know, we always talk about what are the downstream effects? Well, the downstream effects of hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, aches and pains. We didn't even talk about that. You know, we know that women, when they go through menopause, have a lot more joint aches and pains. I did a whole podcast on that, and I got a huge, huge response from people saying, oh my God, I thought I was crazy because I was so achy and so sore all the time. And then when women go on hormone therapy, that achiness and soreness goes away. But if you look at the downstream effects, yeah, not wanting to have sex is one of them. I mean, if you're exhausted and you're achy and you're flashing and you're feeling just as asexual as can be, not to mention the dry vagina problem, you're just not going to be up for it. You're not going to be in the mood. And we know that these interventions go a long way towards just kind of what we put under the umbrella of quality of life. The quality of life is much, much better in women who take hormone therapy as opposed to women who do not. Now, I just would want to give one caveat as we go forward with all of this. There are about 20% of women that don't have any symptoms at all. Lucky women. And it's not because they exercise. It's not because they do yoga. It's not because they're eating soy. It's because genetically they are just lucky. They just don't have symptoms. And so a lot of times people will say, well, does everybody need to take hormone therapy? And the answer is no. If you're in that 20% that you're not having hot flashes, you're not having brain fog, you're sleeping fine, your vulva and vagina are doing all the things they're supposed to be doing, and your bladder is not giving you any trouble, you don't need to do anything. Then you just live a normal, healthy lifestyle and watch what you eat and activity and all of those things, but you don't necessarily need to add hormones to the mix.
That is a good thing to know. So like it's kind of a wait and see situation. But I hear that not way too long idea, right? So kind of like right. If you're going through that, then like you perhaps want to look into medical intervention or consulting with your physician. The other thing that we often hear, at least I hear a lot about, is about vaginal atrophy. This story of you use it or lose it kind of idea. One of my friends, she's so funny. She was telling me the story of like, you know, this guy is my physical therapist, someone that she has like casual sex with. Is that accurate that the more we have intercourse, it's better it is for our vaginal kind of like thinning situation?
The answer is in some cases. So this is the story. If somebody has pain with intercourse, if the tissue is dry and it is thin, the worst thing they can do is to have a lot of sex. Because as I mentioned earlier, that's just going to cause more pain. It will cause the pelvic floor muscles to tighten up. And then someone could end up with a condition called vaginismus, that the opening of the vagina literally basically snaps shut because it's saying, are you kidding? You know, don't come in here. This hurts. The flip side of it, though, is if someone is having pain-free intercourse, yes, having a lot of intercourse is going to help keep those tissues supple and elastic and enhance lubrication. So my mantra isn't use it or lose it. It's fix it and then use it or lose it. You know, I very often find that someone will come in and say, oh, they haven't had sex for 10 years, you know, for whatever reason. We can make a long list of why that happens. And then they suddenly get a new partner and they find, oh my God, this hurts like hell. And so we do whatever we're going to do, whether it's local vaginal estrogen or pelvic floor physical therapy and get things going again. And then once they're sexually active, if they continue to be sexually active, quite frankly, sometimes they don't even need to continue to use their local vaginal estrogen. I always differentiate between repair and maintenance. So use it or lose it is maintenance, but it's not repair. And that's so important because too often women just feel like, all right, I just got to put up with the pain and push through it. And that is the wrong thing to do. But once you're going, maintain it. And to that same point, if there is not a penis in your life, that's where your sexual tools come in. And I don't call them toys. I call them tools because it's part of your toolbox, meaning that you should be using something in the vagina if you have any interest in having penetrative sex down the road. So a vibrator or a dildo that has the vaginal part. And then, of course, using your vibrator to ensure orgasms. Many women need a vibrator in order to have an orgasm as they age because the clitoral nerves lose their sensitivity. And so that's why I refer to it as a tool, not a toy, because a toy is something to make it more fun, right? But a tool is something that you need to make it happen.
I love that. I hate it when kind of like people present it as a toy. I get the idea, but I can imagine that kind of like alienates so many people and undermine the value of it.
Right. There's nothing wrong with toys. I mean, you should have a whole toy chest full. That's fine. But I think it's just the concept. And particularly also very often I will see a patient who's, you know, has never owned a vibrator in her life. And she's 50, 60, 70 years old. And she tells me that she's not able to have an orgasm. And when I tell her, you know, you really need to use a vibrator to wake up those nerve endings that aren't as sensitive as they used to be. And sometimes they're like, thank God, I'm, you know, thanks for the answer. But sometimes they look a little horrified, like, well, I don't, you know, I don't use sex toys, and which is sad, but, you know, but by framing it and saying, well, don't think of it as a toy. Think of it as a tool. If you didn't know how to swim very well and someone put you in the middle of the lake, you would use a raft to keep you afloat. And that's, I don't know if you've ever talked to or interviewed Lori Mintz. She's the author of.
Oh, yeah. I love Lori. Yeah.
And when she was a guest on my podcast, she gave that analogy. So I want to give her credit that using a vibrator is no different than using a life raft when you're in the middle of a lake that you're not the strongest swimmer.
I love that. What a beautiful analogy. And her book is amazing, Becoming Clitorate. And we interviewed her in the past. So if people are interested, they can check out our episode to learn more about that. Well, when we're thinking about the kind of like intervention for pain that we already talked about. So we talked about physical therapy, hormone therapy. What else is out there? Because I hear a lot about a lot of different interventions.
Well, let's start with the first thing that people do. The first thing most women do is they go for the lubricant, right? And sometimes before they go to the drugstore, they're going to see what they've got at home and they're going to grab the baby oil or the coconut oil and all those things. And I actually had a very, very recent podcast episode on that. I think it was just, it was in September, October, that it was called, Is Your Lubricant Helping or Hurting Your Vagina? Because this idea that you can put anything you want in your vagina and it's going to be okay is simply not true. So if we look at the home lubricants, the things that you're going to get out of your medicine cabinet or out of your kitchen, the problem is those are all oil-based. And first of all, oil-based lubricants are not condom compatible. And for women who are using a condom, not to prevent pregnancy necessarily, but to prevent sexually transmitted infections, then they are going to find that that condom is going to fail. But aside from that, we know that the coconut oils and baby oils, these are very thin. They're really just, it's not enough for most women in order to kind of coat the vaginal tissue to make it pain-free. So I always say to women, yeah, you can use that stuff in a pinch, but that's not what you want to be using on an ongoing basis because there are better things. So what's better? Well, what's better are the silicone lubricants. There are both water-based lubricants and silicone lubricants in addition to the oil-based lubricants. So oil-based lubricants, again, not a big fan. The water-based lubricants are highly problematic because in addition to the fact that a lot of them aren't particularly slippery, some of them are actually toxic to the vagina. Some of the most popular lubricants out there have a lot of additives. They have a very high osmolality, which can actually dehydrate tissue. I mean, think about this. You're using a lubricant to make it more slippery, and in fact, it can dehydrate the tissue. It can break it down. It can cause irritation. It can cause burning, and it can cause an easy portal of entry for sexually transmitted infections. So you can use water-based lubricant, but you want it to be a low osmolality. And I go through all of that in my book. I have a book, Slip Sliding Away, Turning Back the Clock on Your Vagina. So I have all the list of lubricants there. And of course, I go through it in my podcast episode as well. But the problem with the lower osmolality water-based lubes is they're just not all that slippery. They're just not great. The silicone lubricants are really the way to go because they're over the counter. They're super slippery. They're not going to harm your vagina. And there, as lubricants go, those are going to do the best job. But having said that, a lubricant does not change the tissue. It only decreases friction. So it greases the skids. But for some women, if their vaginal tissue is very thin and very dry, I don't care how much lube they use, it's not going to help. They need a prescription product, period. You have to get a prescription. And you know, this is also highly problematic. I mean, it's easy enough for me to say, get a prescription. A lot of women don't have a doctor. They don't have a clinician that they go to. Or if they do, sometimes it's someone that they're not comfortable talking to, or maybe it's an internist or someone who doesn't do this kind of work. So, you know, in a perfect world, everybody would have their menopause consultant, their physician who is savvy and who gets it. But a lot of times that's just not the case. So what does a woman do who doesn't have access to someone who can help them? Well, number one, if they have read my books or they've listened to my podcast, then you know what to ask for, because I get very specific about the products. So if someone goes to their clinician, to their doctor, nurse practitioner, whoever, and says, hey, I would like a prescription for Estring or Vagifem or Intrarosa or whatever product they've read about or listened to from my information, they're most likely going to say fine, and they're going to write a prescription. They're not going to ask any questions, believe it or not. They might not offer it themselves, but if someone has done their homework and they go in and they ask for it, they'll usually get it more times than not. And the other thing is I used to be completely against telehealth and all these online platforms, but I've really changed my mind on that, because I really now acknowledge that the overwhelming majority of women don't have access to a menopause specialist and can't get what they need. And sometimes this is a good way to get what they need. Midi is one that does a very good job. You talk to a phenomenal menopause trained nurse practitioner who will talk to you about your symptoms, and they can very often prescribe without actually examining you. The caveat is, if you're having painful sex and you get a prescription via telehealth, and if you're not getting better, you need to have an exam. There are a lot of other things that can be going on. So it's not going to be one size fits all, but it's a place to start. It's a place to get some access to a prescription medication that you otherwise wouldn't have access to.
Excellent. So we talked about lubricant, kind of like talking with a physician who's a consultant or a nurse practitioner. I have many of my clients that they say that when I bring it up to my primary care, they say, you know, like it, like you, it's sex is not that important, or they feel devalued. So it's good that you're giving people the roadmap of what to ask and advocate for themselves. One of the other intervention I hear is Mona Lisa. What do you think about that?
Yeah. So I have an entire episode on the Mona Lisa laser. It's titled CO2 Laser Helpful or Is It a Hoax? And the short answer to that is, in the right woman who has been evaluated, and if the procedure is done by somebody who knows what they are doing, it can absolutely help in terms of vaginal dryness and painful sex. It doesn't help everything, and it's not going to help everyone. But I have been doing Mona Lisa procedures for, I don't know, 6-7 years, and my success rate is well over 90%. But the reason that my success rate was so high is because I carefully evaluate these women. I do a very, very thorough exam. I check their pelvic floor muscles to make sure that's not the problem. I make sure they're not having other conditions like lichen sclerosis or other vulvar skin conditions. And if they are a good candidate, and obviously very particular about how I do these procedures, you have to treat both the inside of the vagina and the vestibule, the opening, it can be highly successful. But I would strongly caution women about having this done by a plastic surgeon or a dermatologist or someone who is not an expert in terms of vulva and vaginal problems.
Are there any other medical interventions that we haven't talked about related to the painful intercourse?
Sure. You know, so we talked a little bit about the local vaginal estrogen. And while there's a cream, there's a lot of different forms. There's a ring, there's a tablet, there's an insert. There's also a prescription DHEA. DHEA is a suppository that goes in the vagina and it melts. And DHEA is basically a building block for both estrogen and testosterone. Why testosterone? Because in addition to estrogen receptors in the vagina and the vulva, there's also testosterone receptors that are very important in terms of lubrication and elasticity. So for a lot of women, they do much, much better if they use a DHEA as opposed to estrogen. The trade name of that product is Intrarosa. I want to mention that any of these products that I've mentioned, I do not work for any of these companies. I give unbiased, completely, you know, this is the science behind it, and I'm not paid by any of these companies. So Intrarosa is one. Another prescription product is a pill that goes in the mouth, not in the vagina, and the trade name is Asphena. It's Spermafina is the chemical name. And basically, this is a selective estrogen receptor modulator, which in English means that it's either going to stimulate estrogen receptors or block estrogen receptors. And women are familiar with this class of drugs because they've heard of things like tamoxifen that blocks estrogen receptors in the breast. Well, Asphena stimulates estrogen receptors in the vagina. So for women who want to treat these issues but not put something in the vagina, this is a really good option.
Excellent. Excellent. And I can see that you have tons of great content, it seems like, in your show, in your book. So if people want to learn more about you, all of the wonderful resources that you offer, what are some of the places they can go to?
Yeah. Well, first of all, for the readers, I've learned there are two kinds of people, those that read and those that listen. So for the readers, I have a number of books out. My most recent books are a series I'm doing specifically on postmenopause. The first book is Slip Sliding Away, Turning Back the Clock on Your Vagina. The second book is Hot Flash Hell. The third book, which is not released yet, I'm furiously trying to write it and get it out there. Hopefully spring 2024 is on postmenopause orgasm. And those can all be purchased on Amazon, both in either paperback or digitally. I also have my podcast, Dr. Stryker's Inside Information, and basically every single topic we've mentioned today, I have an episode on all of those things in great detail. And a lot of it is stuff that's quite frankly from my book, but I also have a lot of content that you can't find in my books, including some wonderful interviews with guests. I like to bring on a lot of people who know things that I don't know, and they have a lot of interesting things to say. So there's that option. And then the thing I have just launched that I am very excited about is, have you heard about menopause retreats, menopause vacations?
No, but I am already a fan.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this came about, it's kind of interesting. So I often am interviewed by the New York Times for this and this topic. And the New York Times did a story about menopause retreats, menopause vacations. So they interviewed me, and I really didn't know much about it. And I looked into them, and I was appalled at the kind of things that they were telling women to do to help their menopause symptoms. You know, they go off to some lovely retreat and have, you know, beautiful hikes and spa and all the good stuff. And then they'd say, yeah, and you know, these smoothies will help your hot flashes, and let's give you a massage, and it's going to help your vaginal dryness. And, you know, and it's like, are you kidding? So I thought, well, this is crazy. I should do one that's not full of silly information, but it's going to give people real solutions and real answers. So when I was at the recent menopause meeting, the North American Menopause Society, now known as the Menopause Society, and I gathered together 15 of my favorite experts, and we are talking the real experts, the people that are publishing the studies, that are giving the lectures, that are, you know, world renowned for their menopause research. And I said, hey, you want to be part of my menopause retreats? And they're like, yeah, sure. So we were launching that. And it's called Dr. Stryker's Inside Information, Mastering Menopause Getaway Retreats. And we are doing our first one in February in Miravelle Resort in right outside Tucson, Arizona. And it's gorgeous. So we're talking, you know, all the spa stuff, all the good stuff. But then we're going to have seminars, breakout sessions, one-on-ones with amazing menopause experts so that everyone will walk away with solutions. And so for information about that, you can go to my website, drstryker.com. And then, of course, if you follow me on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, I have all that information there as well.
Beautiful. Well, I'm already so intrigued to dive into more of those content. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. And thank you for all of your work, because I know that there are not that many physicians that are invested in helping women in this important chapter of their lives.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate that you're getting the word out there.
My pleasure. As we wrap up today's episode, I want to take a moment to reflect on the incredible response we've received from our listeners. Since our discussion about sexual health series in middle age, specifically about the episode on age gap, I personally got so many messages from women sharing their own experiences with me. I was at Podcast Movement last week and several of podcasters came to me and they were telling me about their experience with age gap relationships. So what are some of the experiences they had? And they were telling me how much the content resonated with them. So I encourage you all to share this series with your friends and loved ones, the ones that are in the middle age, 35 and up, to give them the information that would be beneficial for them. But also, it can be a conversation opener about the experiences that many women have. And before we go, I'd like to ask a favor from you. Please take a moment to fill out our survey and let us know what topics you'd like to hear about in future episodes. I already covered every single request that you guys had and put down in the previous survey. So if there is a topic you want to learn more about, make sure you're taking our survey. At most, it will take 2 minutes of your time. Thank you for joining us today. And until next time, remember to prioritize your sexual health and happiness.
Thanks for listening to the Sexology Podcast. For more great content, visit www.sexologypodcast.com. Please be advised that information presented on this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health provider.